Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi folks, Michael here, introducing another one of our special interview episodes. This is in fact the start of what should be a nice little run of chats with filmmakers behind a handful of films currently screening in UK cinemas. First up, we have Jim Capobianco, the director of The Inventor, which is in cinemas from Friday, 8th of March, exclusively in Vue Cinemas. It was such a treat to speak with Jim. He has an incredible CV dating back to the 1990s, working at Disney, Pixar, on his own independent projects. Credits include storyboards for The Lion King, Hunchback of Notre Dame, story artist credits all through A Bug's Life, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, and then as writer and story supervisor on Ratatouille, for which he was nominated for an Oscar. Also at Pixar, Jim directed the end credits of Wall-E and also wrote and directed the Ratatouille spin-off short Your Friend the Rat. He also directed the animated sequences in Mary Poppins Returns too. But all that leads us to The Inventor, which started out as a short film in 2009 and was then developed into a feature film that we can now watch today. It's a stop-motion film with 2D hand-drawn elements, and it tells the story of Leonardo da Vinci. Let me read from the official blurb here. The insatiably curious and headstrong inventor Leonardo da Vinci leaves Italy to join the French court, where he can experiment freely, inventing flying contraptions, incredible machines, and studying the human body. There, joined in his adventure by the audacious Princess Marguerite, Leonardo will uncover the answer to the ultimate question, what is the meaning of it all? So that's The Inventor, and I'd recommend checking it out if it's screening in a Vue near you. How best to describe it, really? I'd say it's a mix of horrible histories, The Wind Rises. It's really fun. It's got a great voice cast with the likes of Matt Berry and Stephen Fry, Daisy Ridley, Marion Cotillard, but it has a lot on its mind as well, about genius and creativity, being part of history as it's happening all around you, and it's a wonderful stop-motion animated film as well. As I said, it was really wonderful to chat with Jim, and this is quite a wide-ranging conversation about filmmaking, finding a patron, those important moments of encouragement that can have a huge impact on your life. It's also great to hear about Jim's experiences working in stop motion for the first time, and also many of the collaborators and key creative partners he's worked with over the years. Many familiar names that we've discussed in the past on our episodes about The Nightmare Before Christmas and the Henry Selick miniseries. Also a surprise and always welcome appearance from the folks at Cartoon Saloon, who have a long history with Jim. Also, I know we've had a few Pixar people on the pod before, but this is our first one for the Disney nerds out there, and I'm very grateful to Jim for sharing his memories and insights with us. Anyway, that's enough from me. Let's have a listen to my chat with Jim Capobianco.
Jim, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. Congratulations on The Inventor. I suppose let's take things all the way back. Why did you first want to tell the story of Leonardo da Vinci on screen?
Well, I had a short film I made and I finished it in 2009. It was about Leonardo da Vinci. It was done in drawn animation. It's kind of about him wanting to fly, like figuring out how to flight. And as I learned about him, and I read, started reading a lot of books about him, and more about him. I just started realizing, I approach everything through character when I develop projects and work on things. So I was really trying to find out who is Leonardo da Vinci as a character, not just what we think of Leonardo da Vinci as this, you know, kind of genius who did everything and could do no wrong. So I started to learn about him, and you learn about how much he thought himself a failure and procrastinated, had to deal with patrons and life. So I thought, well, that's interesting. I want to tell a story about the real person in a way, or that kind of human element of him. So that's what I tried to pull off in the short, even though it's all pantomime. Tried to really give him kind of a chaplain like feeling to himself. So that's what I wanted to carry on, is to explore him further in a feature film with more territory to like run. Then I started thinking about, well, what area of his life should I work on? I didn't want to tell his whole life story. And there was something intriguing to me about that time he moves to France, which is the last 3 years of his life. And not a lot of people know about that. Even in France, it was interesting. A lot of people didn't know he moved to France. I just thought, well, that's really intriguing. And also, there wasn't a lot written about it or known about it. It's always the last chapter in every biography about Leonardo. And, you know, it's sort of relegated to just the last bit of the story. So it felt like there was a lot of freedom to tell a story there. And also, I would have his whole life that he could reflect on, and I could pull elements from. That's kind of where the whole thing developed from.
I'd love the short. I tracked it down on Vimeo and watched it after watching the feature. And it's beautiful in a different way, such different style. So at what point did you pivot, I guess, away from that hand-drawn, very much line art style to stop motion and with elements of 2D as well?
Well, I love drawn animation. That's why I got into animation. You know, when I was going into animation, there was no computer animation. That's how old I am. So, and I started at Pixar when they were inventing the medium. But so I've always loved drawn animation, and that's in my heart and soul. And so that's why the short is done that way. That's how I know to animate. So then when I was making the feature, obviously make it in drawn animation. But the only problem was, at that time, and I knew I needed to like find money somehow to make this thing, drawn animation was going away. I mean, other than Ghibli and Cartoon Saloon eventually, they were around at that time. They actually just started with my short Secret of Kells was out the same time as my short, and that's how I met the guys at Saloon. So they're doing drawn animation, you have Ghibli, but not in the US. It was starting to go away. Disney sells off their desks. They're moving away from drawn animation. They're going into CG. So I was like, okay, how am I going to find money with a drawn animated movie? So I thought, well, but I also love stop motion animation. I've always thought that was, I don't know how to do it, but I knew I loved it. I thought it was so cool. I used to watch the Christmas specials we have here in the States. And then, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas was really cool. And I grew up with Ray Harryhausen movies and all these films. And I really loved it. And I thought, well, maybe I could do it as a combination. And wouldn't that world look really cool as a model world, a toy world? And so to do in stop motion seemed right, and it felt very Da Vinci like to me, because you work with all these different crafts people, and they're working in metals and wood and fabrics and, you know, real tactile elements. And I thought that's very Da Vinci to me, like you know, inventive too. So, and then the drawn animation obviously is like his drawings, you know, it's he drew, he was an artist and all that. So combining the two just seemed natural and right. And I had no idea how I'd pull it off. So
what was that process like then, I guess, if you'd never worked, you know, in that medium before having to find the right partners and collaborators, I suppose.
Well, as I started developing it, and you know, the way I would work is just I have to create the story. So I wrote the script, and I would do drawings, and so that's all the same process, and even storyboarding it. But then eventually, as they're trying to sell the idea or get money for it, I realized, wouldn't it be, it might be helpful to make a little, to make a build a puppet and then do a few little animated bits with it. And luckily from Pixar, there's a bunch of people who worked at Pixar who used to work on, who worked on Nightmare Before Christmas and at Skellington. So, but then they were doing computer animation and stuff to make a living. So a few of them were still dabbling with stop motion or wanted to do it. So I kind of pulled in Tim Hiddle, who was an animator from Nightmare Before Christmas, really good animator. And he had his own setup, or still does, at his garage in his house in San Francisco, his own stage. So I had a puppet made, put my own money into it, and with an beautiful armature, and actually Merrick Chaney built the armature, and he built the armature of Jack Skellington. So it has that like DNA of, like, you know, our history of stop motion here in the Bay Area. So we built the puppet, and then I had Tim start doing little tests with him. And then I thought, well, let's make a whole like teaser, like a bit, a thing, and that I could use as a selling point, like, oh, this is what the film will look like. The film has dissection in it, like Leonardo, the three things, you know, Leonardo da Vinci did were fly, paint the Mona Lisa, maybe the Last Supper, and that he did dissections. So that's what people really know about him. So I was like, okay, we're gonna have, and in that time period, is that 3 years, he did still do his dissections and stuff. So I thought, well, I'm going to probably have that in the movie, and I wrote it into the script. So, but when we were peddling it around, the feedback I kept getting is, well, this dissection thing, is it going to be gross? And the way I imagined it, it wouldn't be, but I needed to show that. So I was like, okay, let's make this teaser. So I met, through all these connections at Pixar, they connected me to this woman, Kat Alyoshin, who was a producer manager in stop motion on Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach and other films, Coraline even. And so she connected me to all these other artists, and she produced the teaser with me. And we made this right when I got assigned to, I had left Pixar at this point, and I was just got the job to work on Mary Poppins Returns, but that I had already put this in motion to make this teaser. So I was like juggling both of these projects at the same time. And we brought in a bunch of artists from Nightmare, and they built this sets, the puppet, the props. Two animators, Tim and one other animator, Justin Cohn, did the pieces. And we brought in a cinematographer, Peter Sorg, who worked on Frankenweenie, and actually he did the recent Henry Selick film as well. So I had a real stop motion cinematographer, everything. So we made it like that. And so it was my trial by fire too, of like how stop motion comes together, what the people are like who work in stop motion. They're very different than other animators in some respects. And kind of just how the whole process works, and also how the limitations of the process. So that kind of allowed me to kind of understand it more. I still didn't claim that I was an expert in any way, but I kind of got to understand it.
What surprised you about it? What do you discover in that trial by fire?
Well, the thing I learned is you can have all these things you want it to do. Like, you know, I'm used to drawing animation and then CG animation, where pretty much anything you think of, you can kind of do drawing animation as long as you can draw it. Computer animation has evolved to a point now where you can do whatever you want. In stop motion, it still has the limitations of that. It's a physical thing that you're moving around. And you can only do what the puppet is built to do. And humor, in a way, I found, is a little more difficult in stop motion because animation, we rely sometimes on the very, you know, the real caricatured movement or expression, extreme things, you know, the take is a big thing, like, whoa, like, you know, that, you know, really extreme emotional or humorous things that happen, the stretching of pieces and stuff, the squash and stretch of animation. But you don't have that in stop motion because you have a rigid puppet. And unless you plan to make special things or you to design it in a sense that it can do other things, you're limited to what you build the puppet to do. And that to me, I even though it's kind of obvious, I didn't really think of it in that way. And so making the teaser and seeing, oh, okay, this is what it can do, helped me actually develop the film further, because then I could kind of adjust kind of the storytelling a little bit and how things would eventually be staged and how the acting would play out. And the other thing is my design. I have these dot-eyed puppets, and you know, Leo has a mouth that appears in the teaser. He has no mouth. He's very minimal expression elements. There's eyebrows, right? So given that, it's like, how do you get the acting from those small elements and stuff? So all these challenges were kind of introduced to me in a way by doing that teaser. And then, they, you know, needed to be surmounted when we made the feature film. So,
and was that mostly in France, that production for the actual feature part of it? Yeah.
So the feature film, yeah, was all made in France, a studio called Folioscope. Mm-hmm. And they grew out of another studio called Folamage, which is much more established and had done stop motion and drawn animation. They brought together the whole team we worked with. So the only person from the teaser that transferred over to Folioscope was Kat, Callie Alyoshin. So she brought the American kind of way of planning a feature film to the French, who I learned, it seems, they just kind of like, I don't know if it's willy-nilly, but it's like they don't necessarily plan their films very rigidly, felt like. So this production, because it was such a small budget and kind of ambitious, it really needed to be planned very precisely. And I got a sense there's more of a laissez-faire nature in the French production. So she was able to, very important, was able to kind of plan the film in a way that we were able to make it, finish it. The other key person was my co-director, Pierre-Luc Grandjean, who had made many stop motion films before, in French films. And he actually, one of his films, The Four Seasons of Lyon, which took this little bear character and you follow him through the four seasons of the year and four different stories. And I looked at his stop motion films, those films, and I was inspired by them. I used them as like a reference to go, oh, the film could kind of feel like this. Or he did things with like 2D elements like water and stuff like that, and I thought, oh, maybe that's how I can integrate it and stuff. So I found his stuff really charming, but I never thought I'd meet him or work with him or anything. And then when I connected with Elon Yarose, who runs Folioscope, I mentioned this to him and he said, oh, well, Pierre-Luc works with us. He worked on our last feature film. Do you want to meet him? And I'm like, yeah, that'd be cool. And he said, well, maybe he could be your co-director. And I was like, wait, what? How could that be possible? So I met Pierre-Luc, and because I was so into his work, our sensibility was totally connected, and as a person we connected, and it was great. We were like two brothers who had been separated at some point, so which was great, because again, I didn't know my ass around stop motion. So he was able to kind of guide me through this process, and I let him do what he does best, and I concentrated on the story and the overall feeling and the what I wanted the film to be, but he was able to translate that into the practical and make stop motion happen. And I learned more and more from him. And again, I learned what's difficult, what's easier. And as from Kat's plan, she made this giant board called the Big Board, and it had three weeks laid out, and you could see what sequence or scenes were coming up. And I would look at that board and go, okay, well, that's coming up in 3 weeks. That's going to be a really difficult scene because it has multiple characters and stuff. And then I would go, well, maybe we keep it that way, or is there another way I could work? And so I would rethink stuff on the fly and go, well, maybe it only has two characters in it instead of three, and the third character can be a cutaway or something. So I would then bring those ideas to Pierre Luc. I'd go, hey, I got a new idea for scene, blah, blah, blah. And he'd be like, his eyes would get really big. He'd be like, he'd get really worried I was going to make it more difficult. And I would say, no, it's going to be great. And I'd show him what I planned out. And he'd be so happy I made it a little simpler, but better. I wouldn't do it just to be simple or economical. It would have to make the story or the way the story's told more interesting or to help the film along.
You mentioned something that I found really fascinating watching the film was this aspect you have all the way through about how important the role of a patron is and how the almost the boundaries of the inventor's imagination is defined by the whims of the patron. I wondered, working within animation, how reflective of your experiences is that you're up to the whims of the people up top? And then working independently, how differently that is.
Well, yeah, I mean, working in a big studio, you are beholden to the powers above you. It's interesting because at Disney, you are more beholden to the executives and their whims. And then at Pixar, which was, I think, its success during the period I was there, was the top people were very creative. They were not executive people. So you had John Lasseter, Andrew Stanton, and these guys who ran the show. And then you had Steve Jobs over them, who he is very creative in his own way. And he recognized, I have no idea how animation works. I'm going to let these guys run things and I'll just protect them. And that was the best situation. And that's why those films were so great, because Steve was able to kind of protect the creators from the kind of executives from Disney who were, you know, they only distributed the films at that time, but they had a lot of say over things. But Steve was able to go, you know, no, let these guys do their thing. And so, you know, I think it depends on your patron. You want to find the right patron, the right bosses that allow you the freedom that you can create what you can create with guardrails. You know, it's not like the guys at Pixar could do whatever the hell they, you know, were just going to go off the rails. Steve would kind of ring them in, but they were given enough freedom that they could create this new medium. So I think it was good for me to work in that environment. I think I was able to excel as well. I think all artists can, when you're constrained by kind of arbitrary ideas of things, you kind of don't know what the playing field is anymore. And I think the best way to create is for the artists to know the space they get to work in and how, what that means. So like for the inventor, I knew the budget and I knew the timing we needed to, the time frame we had to make the film. I knew the artists, I kind of got a sense of the artists I was working with. So then I was able to kind of develop and design the film to fit that because I understood that world. And then my job as a director is to do the same for all the artists. It's like, I will now, because in a way I'm their patron. So I would tell the artist as much information as I can, explain what they needed to do and understand their parameters of things so that they would then be able to create within the space and understand in a way the limitations and the areas they can push through and be really creative and inventive. And I think that's the best way to work. I think, having a benevolent patron is the best way.
I'm sure it does, and it's something we come up with time and again talking about studios and the way that we do on the podcast, where we look at the stories of studios and how they maybe start up and then have to formalize, professionalize, all part of those the stories of how to be creative in a capitalist system, right?
True. I mean, I had no over me. I didn't really have anything other than the budget and the time frame. So I was able to have like complete creative control and on everything. So which is pretty rare. I mean, I don't actually expect that necessarily in my next project. So I think, I think it was sort of a gift for the, on this film, though the budget was really low. So I wouldn't mind just a slightly bigger budget. That would be nice.
Are you something of a history buff? Because
I do.
the
I like
inventor,
history a lot.
because the Ratatouille short as well, it's done as a sort of spoof educational film, but it has a lot of history in it. And I went back and watched the WALL-E credits because I saw that you were involved in directing those, and that's a beautiful sequence going through like the history of art in just 5 minutes. So are you always finding ways to put that in your work?
I do like history. There's a lot of great stories in history, and I think it's great to mine that, breadth of adventures and fascinating people and characters and all that. So to me, it's really interesting. I usually read nonfiction books mainly. I just have always loved history since I was in school. It was my favorite class. I had good history teachers too. They didn't make it boring. I had one history teacher in high school who really was very funny and entertaining, and he made it fun, So I think that probably had an impact on me as well. I love doing the research on for films, so because again, I'm diving into like history or folk tales or different storytelling, and to me, to then seed that into the project making. So I mean, that's how the Your Friend the Rat short came about, because it was from the research for Ratatouille. So we researched kitchens and cooking in Paris and France, but also rats and what rats were all about and how they work and live and stuff in their communities. And then I started seeing how they were so connected to human history, and kind of we've always been together. So, and I thought, well, this would be funny. I found parts of it funny and weird. So I always love these edutainment films that Disney made with Ward Kimball in the 50s, like Man in Space and Mars and Beyond, and also the musical ones they made, like Two Whistle Plunk and Boom and stuff, that went through like a history of these things, or educational in a sense. So I thought, well, I want to make something like that, and then this opportunity came up with the short. So I pitched it as that, and they Brad Bird was like, yeah, you got to make this. So that's how that came about.
Looking at Ratatouille, and when you have story credits and all sorts of names involved in that, where do we find you in that mix? Is it the research? Is it the nerdy stuff?
Oh, and Ratatouille, well, I was the first artist on with the first director, Jan Pinkava, and so I was brought on as his story supervisor. So I would run the story team of storyboard artists. And when I first got on, Jan was having trouble with his writers. He wasn't really connecting to any of his writers, and the story he wanted to tell was this really weird, oddball thing, so about a rat who wants to cook in Paris. And he really had a sensibility to the way he wanted to tell it. So I told him, I said, Jan, I think the only way we can move forward is if we write the script. And so he was really like, well, do you think we can? I'm like, sure, why not? Let's give it a try. So we wrote the original script of the film together and kind of laid out kind of the groundwork of where it would evolve from. So had a lot of the elements that ended up in the final movie. And then from that, we started storyboarding it and developing it further and further. And then brought on some other writers, and they came in and worked on it too. And then that evolved eventually where we handed it up. Brad Bird came on, and then he wrote the final version and finished out the film. And it's an interesting film, and I was nominated for an Oscar for it. And it's interesting because it's Jan, me, and Brad, three, And it's really the three of us that brought the story, that story to life. Because if any one of us had made that film, it wouldn't be that film. So it's really quite, I think, a special film in that way, in that it went through a beautiful creative process, in a sense that he came out. And yeah, I love it. I think it's great. And it's really adored in France, so which is good. Could have been hated, but they really embrace it. And that was really helpful for me in getting the inventor started, because it opened a lot of doors. Like, it really did. Because people would be like, "Oh, you wrote Ratatouille. What do you got? Well, let's hear it. We want to hear your story." Or, "Oh, he's the guy who wrote Ratatouille. We can make this film," or something. So it helped a lot.
That's really good to hear. Yeah, I'm looking forward to sharing that with my kid. He's currently 5, and I'm sort of parceling out the films that we're watching. One film we did watch over the weekend was Song of the Sea, the cartoon saloon film. And I'm intrigued to see that you were story consultants on a couple of cartoon saloon films. So what role did you play with them? Were you giving them advice on how to shape their screenplays, or how did it work?
Yeah, they'd bring me in, and yeah, I have a kind of a pseudonym on their films, and they would just show me the script. I'd give them notes. Wolfwalkers, they brought me in even earlier, where they kind of pitched me an earlier version of it. And I actually, on that one, I said, "Well, originally the Robin character in that was a boy," and I was like, "Well, would you guys ever think of what if you made Robin a girl, and that made it even more difficult for the father, and it sort of would add this different element to it?" And so they really embraced that, obviously, and that's helps them shape the story. So yeah, and then Song of the Sea too, I would just like weigh in and give them input. It's always been a really great relationship between me and them ever since the original short. I mean, it's weird there, because I was showing that short, and we showed both of our films at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, and my short was in the shorts program. And so Tom's sitting next to me, and we're watching the program, and then my short never showed.
Oh,
So I went up
right.
to the program, and I'm like, "My short was supposed to be in this program, and it's not there." And they're like, "Oh my gosh!" And they freaked out. And they're like, "Oh, well, we're showing the program, in 2 days. Why don't we? We'll put It'll be in there for sure." And I'm like, "Well, I won't be here. I have to leave." And I said, "Well, but you're going to show Secret of Kells tomorrow. What if you put my short in front of Secret of Kells?" And they're like, "Really? Would they be fine with that?" And Tom was like, "Yeah, let's do it." So they kind of fit in a weird way, because mine's about drawing, and as just made of drawings, they're very rough drawings. And their film, being a drawn animated film, and also had like a quality to the line too that was a bit rougher and stuff and stylized. So we showed the films together, and then they also, my memory is right that during that trip, they also learned they got nominated for an Academy Award. So we've always been kind of connected in a lot of ways. So helping them has been great. I was just in Ireland with the film at the Kilkenny Animation Festival, and I stayed an extra week to hang out at the studio and kind of help them on a few of their next projects. So it's fun. It's an ongoing relationship. It's great.
And then you had was Tom a 2D consultant on The Inventor, and also was Ross Stewart on some concept art?
Because the film was in development for like 10 years. So so during that time, yeah, I'd say, "Well, I don't know, could Ross do a couple of paintings?" And he did a few things. And then my dream was that Tom would actually co-direct and do the 2D animation. But then as the film started to now coalesce and was going to be a thing, he was still busy with Wolfwalkers, and it just wasn't going to be, it wasn't going to work. But Tom stayed on. He came for like a week and hung out, did some drawings, and sort of inspired the crew. Saloon was great. They loaned us an animator and paid a salary on the film. So that friendship has just continued. And then when I finished the film, I was in Ireland, because that's where we did our post. The final QC check, I invited Tom, Paul, and Nora, and Jerry to come and watch the film. And so they're the first to actually see the final film.
Oh, great. This might be a silly connection to make, but since Leonardo da Vinci is such a figure in the Renaissance, and it's even actually a theme in the film, really, where he probably doesn't realize that he's in the middle of this great period of history. He'll be remembered in a certain way. What was the experience for you being part of the Disney Renaissance? Did it feel at the time like there was something major happening, or is that just something that we've applied to it separately?
I felt like each film was doing better than the last film. It was sort of special, and so I think you felt like you were on something, like something was happening, but I don't know if you really necessarily know it's a renaissance at the time. Feels a little too pretentious to say that. So I guess maybe that's it. But it's exciting to be creating what you're creating, and you realize when you're creating good things that are that the audience and the people out there are responding to in a really positive way, then you it makes you feel good and makes you like kind of want to make the next thing as good or better. So it just sort of had a way where it just sort of built upon itself. And I think I feel very blessed in that I was there during the Disney, kind of the height of the Disney Renaissance, and then also with Pixar's rise and being part of that evolution. I mean, and you can really think of it as animation's Renaissance, really, because we're now in a whole different world of animation than when I went to school and what decided to go into animation. It was very sparse out there. There wasn't a lot happening, and it's a totally different world now with so many different artists involved and different specialties, and more women are involved now in animation than when I was there when I was starting out, which is so cool. And then also these new voices, at different ethnicities and different ways of people are and living and stuff. So I think it's just opened the doors to a great, rich world now. And the technology too has like been so able to allow more people in to democratized it more.
Yeah, what was it that inspired you to take animation as your path through life? Was there something you watched at an impressionable age, or?
Yeah, I mean, I watched everything. I loved Bugs Bunny cartoons and the Disney films, and they would keep the Disney films would show up every 7 years. They'd have a like an old film would show up in the theaters back then. And then Star Wars came out, which had animation in it in a way, and the filmmaking in it was very magical. When I was 8 years old, it came out. So all these elements were like, wait, there's somebody who actually makes these things. At first, as a kid, you're like, oh, it just magically appears. But then you realize, oh, wait, there's actually human beings behind this, artists and stuff. Maybe that's more apparent to like 5 year-olds. Actually, when we were doing the talks in France, like to the school groups, there was a 6 or 7 year-old girl who was like, so did you use green screen? And I
What?
was like, what? Wow, like these kids are so cinematic savvy now, so it's amazing. But I just loved animation, and I wanted to be, and I love cartoons, like comic strips and that. And that's originally what I was thinking. Oh man, I'll do that. So at that time in the U.S., we had Calvin and Hobbes and Far Side and Bloom County, all at the same time. These great comic strips. So I want to do that. And I'd made a comic strip from my high school. But then I'm glad I didn't do that because that went away. But that sort of evolved into learning more and more about animation. And then I had a teacher at in high school who had a program called graphic arts where you'd make t-shirts and sculpture and different forms of art other than just traditional art form, more like commercial arts. And one of them was, and he had one assignment that was an animation assignment. And I was like, I really want to do that. And I couldn't wait to do that assignment. The assignment came along. He's like, okay, we're doing the animation assignment. Most people did like paper cutout or things with Super 8 camera. I was like, I want to do a hand-drawn animated short. And my teacher was like, I have no idea how to teach you that. But he gave me a book. He's like, here's a book. And I made up my own little light table and registration with rulers or something. And I animated for like 2 weeks So the assignment length. And then he's like, well, you're the only person who works in my class. Everybody else was using it as like a pothead blow off class or not doing anything. And so he's like, just keep going, because I hadn't finished the film, obviously. So I kept animating the rest of that year, my junior year. And then my senior year, I took graphic arts too. And he's like, well, you still haven't finished the film. Keep going. So I had my own animation class for like 2 years in high school. And that totally was like, and I was like going to CalArts and stuff. So that, you know, these people in your lives who you meet, who change the direction in your life.
Yeah.
And it's just really true. You know, there's, you know, so he's definitely somebody I can point to go, this guy changed my life, because he's a great teacher. This legacy is what, in the way, the inventor is kind of an homage to these people who inspire you and who give you that space that we're talking about to like be creative. And you know, and that's their legacy. They touched you in a way and changed the world in a sense. So in a way, you can think about that teacher. His name was is Mr. Schmaltz.
Schmaltz.
And it's really funny. I love. And he, you know, you can think of it in a way. So everything I've created is because he did that for me. So that carried on through, like, Ratatouille wouldn't be Ratatouille if Mr. Schmaltz didn't give me this chance to animate in his class. That ripple effect is amazing. You know, the inventor wouldn't exist if he didn't do that.
And it's something you only realize maybe later in life, how important those people are.
Yeah,
important those experiences are, and those moments of encouragement. But Jim, I wouldn't be doing my job if as a host of Ghibli Attack if I didn't ask you about your relationship with the films of Studio Ghibli, because we hear all the time about how Pixar, Disney, beyond, you know, these films are watched and appreciated. How did Ghibli come on your radar? What was the first you heard of their films?
When I was at CalArts, the Joe Rampt, who was my storyboard teacher, he's a great. He's a great story artist himself. He brought Totoro. Totoro had just come out that year or the year before. And they screened Totoro for us. And I was like, whoa, this is so cool. I just loved it. You know, it's so charming, and the characters you know, it's just magical film. Making and a magical film. So that was my first Miyazaki film I saw and introduced to him. And then, you know, and then as his other films came out, I tried to see what I could and, you know, and just was impressed by each one. And then we'd get the art books. I have a whole shelf of all his art books here and would like peruse through them. And I love, you know, he storyboards all his own films, and being a storyboard artist myself, you know, you're just like pulled into that. You're like, what? He boards his own films? Oh, look at the director boards his films, right? That's not always the case. So in the world I worked in American animation, so to see that he's so hands-on involved like that was also very intriguing to me. And, you know, and his drawings are beautiful, and the way he does them are really lovely. In a way, I think in a sense, I channeled that when I did my storyboarding, because I like to draw them in these little books and just with pencil, and then do some watercolor wash on them. And that's, you know, kind of his methodology. So, and in the inventor, I boarded probably half of the movie. So right. Yeah, and the way I write too is I have to write and draw. So the writing, the drawing informs the writing, and the writing informs the drawing. And I think that's what storyboarding is in animation, feature animation. It's a writing process. It's not just like depicting shots or like planning things out. It's really part of developing the story itself. And that's the best way it works. And that's the way Disney, way back when in the Walt days, there was no scripts. They just boarded everything and then would write the dialogue down to record it. So that's how the evolution of film animation began, was just through drawing. And then obviously the Hollywood system, as it, animation moved into kind of the modern Hollywood system, it's like, oh no, you have to have a screenwriter and blah, blah, blah. So then screenplays became the main thing, and then storyboarding, though through Disney and Pixar, still carried on. You must storyboard along with the writing, and they must interrelate. So that's been my, like, that's how I do it. That's the way it's done. So, I mean, to see, that's how Miyazaki works in a sense. Like, he doesn't seem to script. He starts just storyboarding. So I just love that. I think it's great. And so that's, in a way, that's what I appreciate about him and his work. I mean, I'm so intrigued by the storytelling, because it's not like the traditional Hollywood movie. So it's like, why is it so effective, right? Why does it work so well? And it, I think that's an interesting thing to explore. And I think it's also, I mean, I've watched some of his movies. They're a bit opaque sometimes. Like, I don't quite understand. And it's okay. You know, that's okay. And I think in Hollywood, like, if you were going to pitch a Miyazaki film here, they'd be like, wait, what? That's not going to work.
That opacity, though, sometimes comes from, you know, his storytelling sensibility, his worldview, the types of stories he's telling, but also the way that he makes those storyboards and scripts, where he starts and then production starts, he'll hand in the first, it's five acts or something, five sections, he'll hand in the first batch while he's still writing the rest. Which is so the opposite of how we think about doing things if we're doing things properly elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my experience with animation, working at Pixar, and definitely Pixar, there's only been a few films where I've started where there's been a complete script. Mm-hmm. And you were like, okay, we know where we're going. Like on The Lion King, when I was brought on, I think there had been past scripts, but they had thrown them away. And we were just boarding as the writers were like, trying to keep up with us and giving us pages while we were boarding stuff. And I mean, I boarded a sequence where I was just given a paragraph, this is what it's about, and I had to think out the whole film, that piece. And then the writers wrote what I came up with, so there was this flow. So in a way, that Miyazaki would give, okay, here's the start, and I'm going to keep working on the rest, isn't that different than some of the stuff I've worked on? And several of the films I've worked on, they were like, the third act was non-existent. And then it was like, Jim, here, go develop the third act. And you'd go and kind of create something. So you're kind of like, again, it's like, I think the writing and the drawing are all one piece. So in a sense, the same with Miyazaki, it's the drawing and it's writing. So,
Jim, this has been such a pleasure speaking with you. One question, my final question, it's a question we ask all our guests on the show. So this show was all started from a recommendation where my co-host Jake hadn't seen any Ghibli films. So we watched all the Ghibli films and shared those films between us. And ever since then, we've been following filmmakers and studios who feel like they've had a good body of work, a series of films that are worth watching and consuming as a whole. So after Ghibli, we did Cartoon Saloon. We did Henry Selick and Laika quite recently as well. And we love to ask our guests what filmmaker or studio you'd recommend that we dive into as a filmography that's worth looking at that way.
For animation films?
Could be anything. We've had all sorts of recommendations in the past.
Well, animation's tough because there's not many like groupings, which is too bad. I mean, I think there will be, but right now it's just... Because you've already named like a group thing. Like, I would have said Saloon, but you've already done them. Well, filmmaker wise, I have do that all the time. I get obsessed with one filmmaker and I've got to watch their movies, like Kurosawa or Kubrick. Stanley Kubrick's a good one because I watched all his movies when I made the first short film. So that was cool to watch. Because what's interesting about that is you can see, like, if you start with the first film and you go through progressively, you can really see the evolution of the filmmaker. So it's really interesting to see how they got better, what their themes they followed and all that. So recommend that. Billy Wilder is great too. Look at Billy Wilder's movies. Yeah. I love his writing. So he's a good one to look at for writing too. Animation, you could go like back in time too. You could look at like the UPA shorts, because there's a great collection of UPA shorts on DVD. You generally find them on the internet too. So they're amazing too, stylistically, and just the artists who are involved. A lot of them came from Disney and were kind of either fired because of the strike they had in the 40s, or just were tired of the like that method of animation and wanted to break out and do different things. So those are fascinating to plow through. But also like the Warner Brothers shorts, I think are amazing to analyze and watch. And you could go by director, like you watch all of Chuck Jones's shorts and just see how he evolved as a filmmaker. Well,
Well, that's like
it's
seven or eight recommendations there, Jim. Thank you so
that's
much.
historian in me, I guess.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks.
It's been really fun.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Thank you to Jim Capobianco for joining me on the podcast this week. The Inventor is in UK cinemas now, screening exclusively at the Vue cinema chain, so check your local listings if you're interested in watching the film. But also I'd recommend checking out Jim's other work as well. I think the 2009 short Leonardo, which fed into The Inventor, is well worth watching. It's a really beautiful short film. And we talked about all sorts of films and filmmakers in that conversation, many of whom that we've talked about or talked to on the podcast in the past. You can go back to our Henry Selick miniseries for special episodes about The Nightmare Before Christmas, James and the Giant Peach, and Coraline. You can listen to our whole Cartoon Saloon miniseries and our interviews with Tom Moore, Nora Toomey, Paul Young, to follow the growth of that studio through the years. And there are Pixar people as well. We spoke to Domi Shi, director of Turning Red. We also spoke to Enrica Casarosa, director of Luca, and also screenwriter Mike Jones. Dig back through the archive. You never know what you might find. And if you want to go deeper, there's also our Patreon, patreon.com/Ghibliotech, where we put out our Patreon-exclusive bonus episodes, where Jake and I talk about all the things that we do when we're not talking about animation. You can also pester us in real time on social media. We are Ghibliotech on Twitter/X and Ghibliotech.pod on Instagram. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thank you. even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.